as they might say on television shows that are continued previously in Brother Benny's sermon. I told you last week I had a two-parter. As I studied this morning, I said, Lord, do we need to make it a three-parter? Because there's still a whole lot to cover. I am going to give just a synopsis for those who were not here last Sunday. We read from Jeremiah and Isaiah. In Jeremiah, the 18th chapter, we read the first 13 verses. And this dealt with Jeremiah being told by God to go down to the potter's house. And the potter made vessels, and he saw that sometimes vessels were marred. In other words, they were imperfect. And so the potter would just take the clay and rework the clay and make something else out of it, something beneficial and useful or attractive, whatever it might be. And so God had told him, so you go and watch the potter, and I'm going to tell you something. And so he observed the potter, and then God said, as you see the potter's hands mold and make the clay, he said, can I not do the same for Israel? And if Israel messes up and really is marred, can I not destroy it and rebuild it? Can I not do it again? So he made the comparison of that piece of clay being unuseful and then being made into another ball of clay that can be brought up into a useful object. I have a piece of pottery up here to kind of represent that last week. I have a different piece today. But we went to Isaiah then, and we found in the 45th chapter of Isaiah, Isaiah asked, was asking Israel really, he said, will you strive with your maker? And he went on and he says, does the clay say to the potter, you know, why'd you make me like this? You know, the clay doesn't have any say in it. The maker of the pottery has the say in it. And of course, what God was making plain to Isaiah to tell the people of Israel was that God has made us. He made us in the creation. He made man. He put man into working mode and gave us things to do and opportunities and privileges and so forth to do it. Just as he made earth and he made the man and made man, he also made nations, that he would build nations up and he would tear nations down. He would give them power and take that away from them. So he made a comparison to that. And then in the 13th verse of that chapter, he made reference. And if you just read it not along with the chapter, by itself, it doesn't seem like all that much. But the reference was to Jesus. And there's four things basically he said in that one verse. That Jesus would be raised up in righteousness. In other words, he wouldn't do anything wrong. He was sinless. And then also that he would build a city. And I talked about that a little bit. And that city was representative of both of his kingdom here on earth, which is his church kingdom, as well as what Jesus said to his apostles. When he says, you know, if I go away to prepare a place for you, I'll come again. But he had told them, he said, I'll go to prepare a place for you. He said, in my Father's house are many mansions and so forth. And I gave just a little bit of that information about that. He went to prepare a city for his church. In John, we see that city coming down out of heaven, or John did, and wrote about it, as a bride adorned for her husband. This is the place for the dwelling place of God's children that are in his church. And I don't mean that's got their names on a church roll somewhere, but that have been faithful enough in the judgment of God to be included in that entity that will be married unto Christ and have that special relationship. Now, everybody that saves is going to be in heaven. Those that were before the New Testament, before the church was established, they're going to be there and they're going to have their place. But the church is the institution Jesus set to carry the gospel, as it was mentioned in the Sunday school lesson this morning. And so he was prepare a city. or he would build a city. And the third thing that it says, he would set captives free. He would set captives free. That just means he'd save people. That's what he came to do, is to seek and save that which was lost. And so this was the purpose of Jesus in coming, that he would live a sinless life. He would build his city, as it were. He would start his church to be carried on. And he said, I'll be with you always, even until the end of the age, so that it would be there as time progressed. And until time is no more, and that he would save those who were captive or those that were lost. We had a few other things to say about that, but that's generally what we talked about. And then I kind of concluded a little bit with the fact, the warning that both Jeremiah and Isaiah gave to the nation of Israel was that if you fail me, if you don't do the things that you should do, then I can destroy you. I can tear you down. Of course, he gave those warnings to Israel, and we find that they came to pass at later times. Today, we're going to go to the 19th chapter of Jeremiah, the following chapter after what we just read. And I'm going to begin with reading the first nine verses of the 19th chapter of Jeremiah. Thus saith the Lord, go and get a potter's earthen bottle, and take of the ancients of the people and of the ancients of the priests. Now I brought in, actually this is a cover jar, but it's kind of in the shape of a bottle. It just has one that I happen to have available for the purposes of today. But he said to get an earthen bottle and take the ancients of the people, and that just means the wise and the older ones, the ones that had accumulated knowledge and understood the law, and or at least was supposed to understand the law. And he says, take these people and of the ancients of the priest. In other words, the wisest and the most experienced of the priest. And go forth unto the valley of the son of Hinnom, which is by the entry of the east gate. That's that eastern gate that we talked about a few weeks ago when I had the maps up here. The eastern gate is also called the sun gate, because that's the one that the sun first hits in the morning when it rises, or when the earth actually tilts, is the way we know it scientifically now. But still, that was where the valley of the son of Hinnom, which was the valley to the south part of the walled city of Jerusalem, began. And of course, this is the valley. We're going to learn something different about it than what we usually say about it, because when Jesus made mention of Gehenna, he was talking about the valley of Hinnom, which is where the garbage dump was in the day of Jesus. It wasn't the garbage dump necessarily at the time that Jeremiah was writing. We'll find out something else it was that wasn't good. But in Jesus' day, it was a garbage dump where they go toss their garbage over the walls, and just the spontaneous combustion of the decomposing material would cause fires to be burning all the time. There, of course, would be worms and all kinds of infested maggots and whatever else might have been there. So it wasn't a very pleasant place to be. And Jesus used that as an example of what hell was like. So that's why I call hell the garbage dump of eternity, where that which is useless, not of any benefit, which is the unsaved, are cast into. And so he said to go into the valley of the son of Hinnom, which is by the entry of the eastern gate, and proclaim there the words that I shall tell thee. So he said, now go get you a bottle, go get you these ancient or wise men of the city and of the priest, and go out there to the valley of Hinnom. And there's a reason for that. And he said, and then I'm going to tell you some words to say. And say, hear ye the word of the Lord, O kings of Judah and inhabitants of Jerusalem. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I will bring evil upon this place, the which whosoever heareth, his ears shall tingle. Now, I told you last week when we talked about he used evil, he wasn't talking about meanness or things that was sinful of nature. He was bringing evil. He was bringing judgment and punishment upon them. So to the people receiving it, it would seem evil. And so God, though, was doing his just duty of bringing punishment upon those that were disobedient to him. And he said that that it even was that whosoever heareth, his ears shall tingle. In other words, just what God is going to bring on this place, it's going to make people cringe. You know, it's going to just, you know, ring in their ears that God would even do such a thing. But listen to what he said. Because they have forsaken me. And that's the key to it right there, is because they have forsaken me. And have estranged this place. Now, estranged just means that they put it aside. They've made it something it's not supposed to be for. And have estranged this place and have burned incense in it unto other gods, whom neither they nor their fathers have known, nor the kings of Judah, and have filled this place with the blood of innocents. Now, he said that they're worshiping other gods. That the ancients didn't know, that our forefathers didn't know. They've just brought these in. They've found them in other places, or they've made them up. But we'll find out specifically what he's talking about in just a moment. And he said he's filled this place with blood of innocence. And again, he's going to explain it. They have built also high places of Baal. In other words, they built altars. They built places of recognition to lift up the name of Baal, to burn their sons with fire for burnt offerings unto Baal, which I commanded not, nor spake it, neither came it into my mind. Now, this is what the people that worshiped Baal did. They offered not animal sacrifices, as God had given as a representation of the coming of the Son of God that would be the sacrifice of men, but they offered human sacrifices of their firstborn sons as was needed to appease Baal. And so they would kill their children. Now, if you'll recall, God tested Abraham with taking his son, Isaac, which was through him was going to be the promise, to go up unto Mount Moriah, which is where the temple was built, and to offer him as a sacrifice. Abraham didn't want to do it, but by faith he carried out the wishes of God. And when Isaac said, well, where's the ram for our sacrifice, or where's our sacrifice? And he just said, God will provide. And he got there and he tied his son up, got everything ready, raised his knife to kill his son, which is what the believers of false gods did in that area, the Canaanites and others that were there at that time. And God stayed his hand. He just wanted to see if Abraham was willing to follow through with that. And when he saw his actions were such that he recognized his faith, and it tells us later in the scriptures that Abraham had the faith that if he took his son's life, that God would raise him up again, which was, a picture of the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus Christ later to come. And then, of course, God had provided the ram that was caught in the bushes so that that would be the sacrifice, the representation of the coming sacrifice of the Son of God. But here he said that I never even intended for this. It wasn't in my thoughts that people actually take the lives of their children. They had shed much blood, innocent blood, there in the valley of Hinnom to the false god Baal. They have built also, I already read that one, in the sixth verse, said, therefore, behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that this place shall no longer be called Topheth, nor the valley of the son of Hinnom, but the valley of slaughter. Now, the word Topheth, or Topheth, just means altar or place of sacrifice. And so it had become to be known as the place of sacrifice. It had come to be known a place of bloody resolve. And then they would bury their carcasses there. But he said that this would be called the Valley of Slaughter. So this also is representative of what Jesus was referring to the Valley of Hinnom as being like hell. It'll be the second death in hell to those that die without God. And they will be there continually, slaughtered forever, if you would. So this is another representation of what hell might be like. But here he's using as example that here are people that are supposed to be servants of God. They're coming out of the city. They're coming around into the Valley of Hinnom. And they are offering sacrifices of their sons for Baal. to try to appease this false god that none of God's people or the Israelites had ever worshipped. Now, they had had that worship around them, but God had never told them to do any of those things that was similar to the worship of Baal. And I will make void the council of Judah and Jerusalem in this place, and I will cause them to fall by the sword before their enemies and by their hands of them that seek their lives, and their carcasses will I give to be meat for the fowls of the heavens and for the beasts of the earth. And I will make this city desolate and hissing. Every one that passeth thereby shall be astonished and hiss because of the plagues thereof. Let me just explain the hissing. The hissing is just, they would use that sound to indicate that they couldn't believe something like this had happened, that it was a cursed place. And they would just go by and they would see the destruction there, and they'd hiss. They'd just give all these sounds of the expression of their air through their teeth and make these sounds to indicate that they can't believe how this destruction came about and how terrible it was. And he's saying that this is what happened when people go by and see this after that it has taken place. And I will cause them to eat the flesh of their sons and the flesh of their daughters, and they shall eat every one of the flesh of his friend in the siege and the straitness, and wherewith their enemies and they that seek their lives shall straiten them. Now the word straight there means disgraced or in anguish. And distress, that he would bring this distress upon them. Now, I read through that kind of quickly, and it was kind of heinous there. But he was talking about the destruction of Israel, and of course, more specifically of Jerusalem, which was the capital of Israel, that this would come about. And when the Babylonians came in later, and that's, of course, as I mentioned last week, Jeremiah was called the weeping prophet. He wept over what God had given him as visions of what was going to happen to the nation. And he was trying to get them to make correction for it, to turn back to God and to turn away from these false ideas and false gods. And so it was foretold through this that they would be destroyed, utterly destroyed. The Babylonian Empire came in, they destroyed it, they destroyed the temple, they destroyed the city, and they took all of the best of the people of Israel that was left alive and took them back into captivity into Babylon. And there they were in Babylon for 80 years before King Cyrus, who had become the king of the Medes and Persians that had overtaken Babylonians. And it was in his heart, that God put it in his heart to let some of them go back to Israel. And so they went back. Nehemiah was the one in charge of rebuilding the walls. And they eventually rebuilt the temple, and it was there again to be used until we find later it was destroyed again. And then Herod had it rebuilt, or at least spruced up quite a bit, and was there. And then Jesus said that it wasn't going to last very long. And sure enough, in 70 AD, it was totally destroyed and it's never been rebuilt. There's a big Muslim mosque sitting there where the temple used to be. But the fact is that these were prophecies given to Jeremiah that this nation, which was the nation of the people that God had chosen as his people, would be destroyed if they didn't repent and turn back to God. And so this was the warning given to them. Now, I want to recall back to the book of Deuteronomy. And we know in the Exodus where the Israelites were released from Egypt, and they got their freedom, and they came and they went to Mount Sinai, and God gave the laws to Moses, and Moses brought them down on the tablets. It doesn't tell this right in Exodus here, but over Deuteronomy, Moses writing about it tells us in the 9th chapter in it's 9th chapter in the 17th verse, I believe it is, in Deuteronomy. And Moses said that I took the tablets, or the two rocks that the law was written upon, and he said I broke it in front of the eyes of the people, that they saw that, because he was so disgusted and God was disgusted at the way that the nation had so quickly turned back to idol worship. Of course, they had experienced that in Egypt, and they had gone back to that while Moses was up on the mountain. And so Moses broke the tablets that he himself said were written by the finger of God. God had written out the 10 laws, the 10 commandments that he put on there, but he had also given him a lot of other information as to how the people were to live by the law. But he broke that, and then Moses had to chisel them out next time himself. The fact was that he broke those laws because the people had turned, and not all of them, but a great number of them, had turned back to false worship. And there, of course, were thousands that were killed because of that turning back. But this was another point in time that was told, or the nation of Israel was told, you either get yourself together and get back to God, or something terrible is going to happen. Now, if we go back to the first verse that we read in the 19th chapter, thus saith the Lord, go and get a potter's earthen vessel. He went and he got a vessel, or a bottle is what he said. But he got that earthen vessel that could be useful for whatever its purpose was designed for, to hold liquids to pour out of, or whatever it might be. And he said to go and to get these ancient people, or the wise people, the older ones that had good knowledge of the word and the history. And he said, all these things that's going on, that you're doing things that our people hadn't known before. And then, beyond what I just read, this was what he told him to do. He said, and then thou shalt break the bottle in the sight of the men that go with thee, and shall say unto them, thus saith the Lord of hosts, even so will I break this people and this city as one breaketh a potter's vessel that cannot be made whole again. And they shall bury them in Tophet, or in that altar place, till there be no place to bury. In other words, they'll just keep on dying, and they'll keep burying them until there's no land left to bury them in. There's nothing left there. This piece of pottery is not useful anymore. I can't reclaim it for any useful purpose. And so he made this demonstration for them to go out and to see that bottle broken. And he said, this is Israel. And when it gets broken, it goes so far, he said, I won't even try to build it back the way it was. I won't try to restructure it. I'm just going to let it die. And that's what happened to them. They were overcome, and their people were killed, and their talented people were taken into captivity. And all of the rest was just left to feed. And that's when he said that they became cannibalistic because they destroyed the fields. They destroyed everything that they had to get sustenance from. And so they began to eat each other. And they would eat their children. They would kill their neighbors and eat their neighbors just to be able to try to survive. And so he was describing that heinous situation and saying that the nation is broken beyond repair. If it's broken beyond repair, what do? You just toss it out. So God was saying that this is what was going to happen. Now, he goes on and says, this will I do unto this place, saith the Lord, and to the inhabitants thereof, even make this city as Topheth. So he said, I'll make this, this city just like I will this place of sacrifice. That it'll be destroyed. And then, of course, it was applied also to the whole nation that it would be destroyed. But since Jerusalem was the capital city, it was the main city that was destroyed. Now, there were people out in the countryside that got taken into captivity, and their homes may be destroyed and all, but Jerusalem was the center point of what was destroyed for the nation of Israel. And as a whole, the nation crumbled and was not capable of functioning again, until it was such that most of those people that had been the leaders in that day had died. In 80 years, most of them had died. Those that hadn't stayed in Babylon, because it was younger men that had been born and grown up in Babylon that was sent back to rebuild the city. And some of the older people that saw the temple rebuilt, they cried. They cried not because they were happy. happened to see it rebuilt? Because it wasn't anything like the first temple. Wasn't anything like Solomon's temple, because all the gold and the silver had been taken out. The cedars had been gone and destroyed. It was made just of rock and stone, and very little of the precious things that were there before was gone. So it was there as a representation of the temple of God, but it was never the glory of the Solomon temple that they had seen before. And so they had to worship in a lesser state because they had broken apart. They had failed God in the past. And he did not let them go back to the kingdom that they had before. Matter of fact, Israel has never been a reigning kingdom since then. They were just allowed to go back and to have a land there. And eventually they went through about two other great empires that had control on them. And of course, the Roman Empire was the one that gave them some bit of restoration. But they couldn't call their land Israel. It was called by the Romans Palestine. And so that's why the Palestinians today say, well, we are, our ancient people were the people that ruled this land, even though that Israel had it long before the Palestinians had it. But they're still fighting over that today as to that one little piece of land over there as to which one should own it and control it. But God has never allowed them to rebuild as a prominent nation. And 1948, May the 15th, whatever it was, when they were declared a nation by the United Nations. An agreement was made. There were still a lot of places, and most of the Mideast countries around them do not recognize them as a nation. And that's why they're still doing battle and trying to overcome them. There's a hatred there because of the hatred of that came from Isaac and Ishmael. And Ishmael being cast out from Abraham's home. But through Ishmael rose a people that became the antagonist to the Israelites. And the Muslim religion developed through and so forth. We're not going to go into all that. But still, the fact is that the nation was destroyed and has never been brought back to prominence like it once was. The 15th of the last verse of this 19th chapter of Jeremiah says, "Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I will bring upon this city and upon all her towns all the evil that I have pronounced against it, because they have hardened their necks that they might not hear my words." They had hardened their necks. They became stiff-necked. They became proud, is what it meant. That they wouldn't listen to the words of God. They wouldn't hear the words of God to know what was the right thing to do. Because God was giving them direction, but they weren't taking the direction. And so they began to gradually go further and further from God. They started worshiping other gods. They started doing things that was contrary to the laws. And eventually they were not recognizable as God's people. Now, all of that being said, I apply that also to other nations and to the nation of the United States, because we're seeing some of the same type things happen. The Holy Scriptures were the basis for the laws that were established in this country. That's why we call it Judeo-Christian a nation. Not that we were all either Jews or Christians, but that we use the tenets or the laws of the Old Testament as well as the teachings of the New Testament to establish the laws of this country. And we are going further and further away from that. And if God said that going further away from his teachings would cause destruction to come for Israel, the chosen nation of God, then what do you think will happen to the United States if we keep going further and further away from what God says? Now, I don't know how quickly that might occur, because things happen and change. Sometimes they can swing back. But the prayer that Solomon had prayed and the answer that he got back when the temple was dedicated was that when people go wrong, if they come back to God and repent, then he'll restore them. He'll bless them again. And this nation can be blessed again. But in the direction that it's going, individuals can be blessed that serve God. Little groups of people that serve God can be blessed. But as a nation, we're going further and further and further away from the teachings of God. And eventually, the little pockets of people that are trying to serve God will not be sufficient for God's anger to be kindled at all the rest of the nation. And he'll bring destruction upon it. And so even the innocent has to suffer that sometimes. Just like Jesus said, now when the Tower of Siloam fell and there was in the teens of people killed, he said, were these the worst people in Jerusalem? Were these some of the worst that this happened to? No, there was innocent people. There was good people that died in that. And the same thing when wars come. There's a lot of good people that died. There's a lot of innocent people that died. When nations fall, there's a lot of innocent people that are affected by it. But the reason that they fall is because of their overall distraction from their service to God. Or their total denial of God not letting him into them that worship. In the book of Psalms, we find some places I want to mention right quickly. In the 127th division of Psalms, he said in the first verse, except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. He's talking about a country here. He's not talking about an individual dwelling place. But he's talking about the country. He said, if you don't build it with the help of the Lord, then you're in vain building it. Because it's going to eventually fall anyway because of the lack of God being there. But then he also gives us warning that if we build it with him and we don't keep it, that things can happen. Going back to the 33rd division of Psalms, we find in the 6th verse, he said, by the word of the Lord were the heavens made and all the host of them by the breath of his mouth. Again, he's identifying the fact that he made the heaven and the earth. He made all of creation. In the 12th verse, he said, blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord and the people whom he hath chosen for his own inheritance. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord. Those nations that have arisen in days gone by, and they have served God. They have been blessed in their service. This nation has been blessed tremendously in the service of God over the years. We have been given abundance and many things that are wonderful for the whole of the country. And for many people that was in the country as it developed, they lived a godly life, or at least as close as they could. Because all sin comes short of the glory of God. But as a whole, the nation served God. And if God is recognized as the Lord of their lives and the Lord of their nation and the strength of their nation, then it'll be blessed. But if that designation goes away, I don't like to play politics in this, but our president said early in his first administration that this is not a Christian nation. He made that statement overseas, that this is, or the United States is not a Christian nation. And we've called it a Christian nation. Matter of fact, 3 times the Supreme Court has declared from lawsuits that was brought against it that this is a Christian nation. Not because everybody's Christian, but because that our laws and the precepts of the way that our country was formed was under Christian guidance, and that it was under the type of things that that Christians do, and our laws were set in such a way. And so God was the Lord of the country. And you go to the early founding fathers, there's very few of them that didn't give God credit for the development of the country and for the winning of the battles when there's no reason that we should have won the battles as far as military might was concerned. And so with God being the Lord of the country and the people he had chosen for his inheritance, you know, he chooses people. He chose the Israelites to be the group of people from whom his son would come that would bless all the world. And he chose his church that Jesus established in his personal ministry to be the means that the gospel was carried out to the world. And it was the chosen people of God. And this nation has been a chosen nation of God because that people that came here, initially many of them came so they could worship God freely according to the dictates of their heart. That's why they left England. That's why they left some other places. Some came looking for gold and silver and whatever. Matter of fact, it was there was a missionary many years ago that was asked in South America, how come that that the United States and that part of North America had prospered so well, and South America, who had far more natural resources than North America did, had languished in poverty. And his answer was, because the people that came to North America, or I'm talking about the United States primarily, came seeking God. Those who came to South America came seeking gold. And they found a little bit of gold here and there, but the gold is still in the ground in a lot of places down there. And a lot of the riches have done nothing to promote the wealth of the people. But the United States has been blessed over and over and over again with abundance when we have less than a lot of other places in the world as far as natural resources are concerned. If a nation is built up under God and maintains its worship and acknowledgement of God as its Lord, then God will bless it and strengthen it. In the 16th verse of that chapter of that psalm, he says, "There is no king saved by the multitude of an host, and a mighty man is not delivered by much strength." And that's not really the verse I meant to read. I meant to go on down to the 18th verse. "Behold, the eye of the Lord is upon them that fear him, upon them that had his mercy." The eye of the Lord is upon them that fear him or reverence him or give respect unto him. And as a nation, if we don't give respect or reverence unto God, then he is going to take note of that. And if you don't reverence God, you're going to get his hand against your backside, if you would. He's not going to bless those, that hope or that don't hope in his mercy. Those that hope in his mercy, he will bless. And then the last verse, the 22nd verse of that psalm says, "Let thy mercy, O Lord, be upon us according as we hope in thee." As we have hope in you, then let your mercy come upon us. And that's, as a nation, our hope is not in what the government can do. It's not what the powerful military can do. It's not what the industrialists can do. But our hope is in God. Because if God is with us, he'll let the nation prosper. He'll let the industrialists prosper. He'll let the military prosper. But if we don't have hope in God, then his mercy is not going to be upon us as a nation. And we will crumble just as a piece of pottery does when it hits a hard surface. In one other passage of scripture I want to make mention of, in the 9th psalm, we find in the 16th verse, it says, "The Lord is known by the judgment which he exceedeth." The rest of that verse says, "The wicked is snared in the work of his own hands." Now, he said the Lord is known by the judgment which he executeth. This is how God is judged. What kind of God is he? Is he a benevolent God, just lets everything go and lets people do what they want? Or does he, when he sees wrong, bring judgment against it? And he said that the wicked are caught in the snares of their own hands. In other words, God doesn't punish people just because he wants to punish them, but it's because of the wickedness of his creation that fails to serve him and acknowledge him that he will bring destruction upon them. And he'll do that for nations also. And then the 17th verse says, "The wicked shall be turned into hell, and all the nations that forget God." Now the wicked themselves, every individual that is wicked, and by wicked he's just talking about they're lost and they're separated from God, that they're going to hell. That's what's going to happen. They're turned into hell because their name's not written in the Lamb's Book of Life. And he said, not only those, but every nation that forgets God. Every nation that has said no to God. The whole nation's turned into hell. Now, that doesn't mean individuals that might be in that nation that are saved, they'll go to heaven. But the nations that have rejected God, they will go down. This is going to happen to any nation, no matter how many it might be. There are nations in the world that have totally rejected the Son of God, have totally rejected the Almighty God of heaven, and they have chosen some other way to go. Now, I believe that there are probably individuals within those nations that get saved, but they have to stay out of sight and underground because they'll be killed for spouting their beliefs whatsoever. But still, the nations as a whole, because they forget God, shall be cast down. They might live a few hundred years in this world and have some dominance in the world, but eventually, just like a lost person, they might fare sumptuously as the rich man did and have plenty to eat every day and everything taken care of for him. But there's going to come a judgment time. There's going to come a time when they have to face God, and they're going to be found wanting, as it was with Nebuchadnezzar, when the scales were weighed. His good and his bad was found wanting because he had no good. He had no belief in God. He had no trust in for salvation through the God of eternity. And so he was found wanting, and he died that very night and was without God and cast into hell. And so it is with everyone that is a nation that forgets God. They will be cast down, and their people will be cast into hell that are unsaved. And those that are saved, we have the promised hope of eternal life with God. And we have that within us. We're not the broken piece. Now, sometimes people's lives can be broken up because of misdeeds and going the wrong direction in life, and those things can be mended. And you know, some small cracks and things can happen in people's lives, but God can mend those. But when they're utterly destroyed and broken apart to where they're no longer useful, then God can take them out of this world. Matter of fact, Brother Sonny and I and a gentleman that was visiting with us in breakfast yesterday was talking about that, and I made mention of some people in particular that died an early age, relatively speaking, and I believe it's because they were saved and they were flaunting God, and they didn't follow after him, and they let their pride and desires of this life overtake them, and I believe God just took them out early because he's going to get honor and glory some way or another from people's lives. We have the responsibility to look at our lives and to look at our nation's life, to look at our church life, and to do all that we can to try to serve God and to put him first. If we want our nation to turn back to God, then we as God's people individually and as God's people as churches need to get on fire for him and to step out and to reach out and to let people know that there's a better way than the ways that have been chosen for this nation. That we need to turn to God. Because if we do that, God will bless this nation again. It's hard to ask God to bless the United States when the United States is not doing well. It's hard to ask God to bless somebody that's living a sinful life. Now, we can pray for their soul if they're not saved. We can pray for their actions to be changed if they are saved, and that their lives can be straightened out. But we should never ask God to bless sin, because he's not going to do it anyway. And he will punish sin. He will bring chastisement upon sin. We can pray, and I've prayed this many times, that for God to bring people down. I don't ask for chastisement on them, but in your judgment, then Lord, you do that which you need. Because I've been chastised when I've been in the wrong, and it's not fun to be out of step with God. And God can bring his hand upon people. If people don't respond to that, one of two things is all I can say, and I can't be judgmental about their soul, but either they are comfortable in their sin, and God just hasn't put it on them hard enough yet, or they never have been saved to start with. There's a lot of people that say they're saved. A lot of people say that I've been born again. A lot of people say, I know the Lord, but their lives sure don't show it. And if their lives don't show it, to me that indicates there's something missing inside. Just because they've said it don't mean they've got it. If they got it, there ought to be a desire to serve the Lord. Now, I understand that people will go for a time, and the Lord will let them go for a time until he jolts them back. And usually it's in a bad way as far as what they think. But to those that have grace in their heart and they get jolted by the Lord, they get chastised by the Lord, they get punished by the Lord, and they get themselves back in track in the service of the Lord, they'll look back and thank God for it because that he loved them enough to straighten them up. Those then that keep rejecting that and keep rejecting that, I believe in order to get honor and glory, he'll just take them out. And he'll let people look over them in their casket and talk about them, good, bad, or indifferent, whatever. But he'll take them out. If they're not going to serve him here, he'll just take them to glory and then serve them there. But they'll still have lost great rewards because of their failure to serve him here in this life. I could go on and on and on with this. We as a nation need to turn back to God. It's very seldom that a week, and probably not a day, hardly goes by, that I don't see something either in the paper, or I don't watch the news too often anymore, but see something or hear something about what our people as our nation, or politicians, or our celebrities, or whatever, are flaunting their lifestyle against God. We hear so much, and it's one of things that has happened. It's not, you know, we can go back 100 years and start seeing the decline as things happen. And as our people and our society accept sinful things that happen, and then they just keep building up. It's just like a kid. If you get away with one thing, he'll try something else. You know, and if he keeps getting away with it, he'll just keep trying and keep going further and further and further away from the wishes of the parent or the teacher or whatever we have the responsibility over. And the same thing, if people get away with things and God doesn't punish them, then they'll just keep doing more and more. Well, if they're not saved, God may let them just go and have a big time. But their ultimate price is what's going to be the problem for them. But the thing about it is, when they go and other people see them getting along and not being chastised, then they say, well, if they can do it, I can do it. And then another one says, well, I can do it if they can do it. And they just keep on and they keep on. And they start going further and further from God. We're living in a time when one of the great sins of the Bible is being accepted more and more in this country, that of homosexuality. And it's getting to be that it's a hate crime to mention it. That unless it's all pat them on the back and say, well, y'all go have a big time in your sin, then if you don't go along with it, then you're homophobic or you're afraid of homosexuality. I'm not a bit afraid of it. I know people that are homosexual. I can get along with them. I can interact with them. But I still don't like their sin. And try to point that out. As we have the opportunities to, and especially from the pulpit, I have a responsibility of saying that it is one of the things that God finds is an abomination. In other words, it's something he really hates, because mankind that he created has deviated from the plan that he had made. And I can go into how I think that came about and what happened and all, but that's not the sermon today. But still, the more our country accepts it, and it's a known fact, every society that has openly embraced homosexuality has soon declined, has gone down, gone away. And we can just see that happening in our midst. And that's just one of many things that is tied to it. It's not just that one thing that happens. A lot of other things that happen to allow that to even come to the forefront that we have declined and gone away from. Our nation needs to come back to God if we're going to have any strength. Because we'll get overtaken militarily eventually. You know, but like Khrushchev said back in the 50s, I guess it was, that he said that we'll not be overtaken military. The U.S. won't be overtaken within. Well, that's getting way too much. But if you follow the Communist Manifesto, gradually our country is falling into the very things that said needs to happen for our country to become communist. Or socialist, either one. And we're going more and more in that direction, thinking that big government can help us in all things, that there's somebody out there that's got a solution, and there is. It's Jesus. He has the real solution, but they look right past him, looking to somebody else, looking for some man. And that's what eventually will bring on the man of sin, because people will be looking for some great man to guide, and then they'll just give in to this man that appears to be the answer. And all he is the counterfeit Jesus, because the devil has always tried to counterfeit what God has done, and the man of sin will be the counterfeit to Jesus, that people will flock to him thinking that he is the answer and overlook the one who's already been here and paid the price and given his all for us. If we're to serve him, we're going to have to stand up in the face of a lot of things. And the Bible says if we live godly, or we live a Christian life, is what it's saying, we'll be persecuted. Now, there's those that have the idea that you do all these things and you give to the church or to them or whatever it might be, and God's just going to bless you and bless you and bless you with all these wonderful things in this life. Now, this isn't where our blessing is. We're just put our treasures up in the heavenly land. And all the other things that we need, they'll be added to us as we need them. And it's good and well if people have a lot, as long as they use it properly. And don't get so wrapped up in that they've got to have that, and they've got to have more of it, and they've got to keep building it to the exclusion of building spiritual things that are going to benefit others and be to our reward in heaven. I've gone longer than I should, but no, I haven't. I've gone just where I need to go. But I thank you for listening. Is there somebody here that's unsaved? Unfortunately, we live in a time when there's a lot less of activities that would point you to Jesus than there used to be. There's a lot more of things that will draw you away from Jesus than there used to be. But it still comes down to your heart. If the Spirit deals with your heart and draws you, then you need to seek the Lord and be saved. Because it's eternity for you. It's not for me. I've got mine taken care of. Most of the people here, by the testimonies I've heard, have gotten things taken care of. But if you disregard what God has provided for you, if you'll die, you'll be one of these broken vessels that have no opportunity to be repaired. Because in hell, there's no opportunity. There's no benefit. You've got time and opportunity while God will work on your soul. And if He draws you in your heart, don't put Him aside. Don't be so proud. Don't be stiff-necked like these Israelites were. They thought they had it all figured out and that they was above God. And that's exactly what a lost person does. They think they're above God because they don't want to come God's way. God has a simple plan. But because of our pride, it's hard to follow that plan. But if there is that knocking and that bleeding in the heart of the Spirit drawing, that's the time to seek the Lord. If that time's now, it'd be a good time to seek the Lord. We have a song. If there's somebody here that's lost and wants to seek the Lord, we'll pull this aside, or you can come to any seat up here, or we'll come to you, that we'll be glad to pray for you, for your soul's condition. We can't pray away your sin, but we can sure pray that God will deal with your heart to where that you see the need so strongly that you're willing to put yourself aside and put your trust in Jesus. Let's stand and pray.
Start page number 121 and sing the first and last verse. Jesus, keep me near the cross. There a precious fountain, free to all, a healing stream flows from. Sing it.